Okay, so we're beginning a new inyan, I guess. We're going to go to the section of Hilchos Ona and Mekachtos.
Recording in progress.
Okay, and the subject that I wanted to focus on today, I didn't know if anyone else would give a chabura on Siman Reish Chav Zayin, so I figured I'd be safe to start with Siman Reish Chav Ches. But it's a sugya of Gnevas Das, which is, of course, a very important sugya, and interestingly enough, does not appear in Hilchos Geneva and doesn't appear in Hilchos Gezela, but appears, interestingly, in Hilchos Ono Mekachtos, which would seem to indicate that it is perhaps an outgrowth to some degree of the Issur of Ono. The beginning of the Siman deals with Ono's Devarim, that you're not supposed to cause somebody distress, even if there is no type of monetary ramification. And many of the cases of Gnevas Das fall squarely into that category, where there may not be any monetary ramifications, but they may involve either a monetary transaction or not involve a monetary transaction. There is some type of an emotional infliction of distress, so to speak, that is being imposed upon the other party through a Gnevas Das, through a deception or creating of a false impression, as the case may be. It's apropos to speak about this topic, particularly this week, because we find it alluded to in this week's Parshas Vayetze, with respect to the whole interaction between Yaakov and Lavan, where Lavan, of course, accuses Yaakov of all kinds of devious dealings, which are, I guess, a classical psychological application of a projection of Lavan kind of attributing to Yaakov which is true with respect to himself. And he says, "Vatignovis levavi, you have stolen my heart." And shortly afterwards, he says, "Vatignovo si." And Rashi says, "Vatignovo si." It really is, on some level, hearkening back to what he just said a moment earlier. Ganavta is dati, that you committed an act of Gnevas Das, that you fooled me and you took away my daughters without any prior warning, and you deceived me. So that's a notion, whether they're true or not, with respect to that particular allegation. And Yaakov also had to deal with an application of the principle of Mikesha, Titakesh, that you have to, you have to deal with tricksters in accordance with their own code on some level. But nonetheless, here we do find a precedent and an origin for this idea of Gnevas Das. Elsewhere in Tanakh, we have the paradigmatic figure of Gnevas Das, which is none other than Avshalom. Vatignov Avshalom Islev Anshe Yisrael, when he was fooling everybody by kind of indicating to his father he's just going to bring a korban, and he was really assembling ranks of all of the Jewish people to take away the kingdom from his father. And Avshalom showed himself capable of that task when he was fooling his brother Amnon into thinking that they were good friends, when actually his half-brother, when he was planning to murder him. So he was sort of the paradigm, quintessential example of Gnevas Das. Gnevas Das really falls into three major categories. I went through one point in time a number of different articles on the topic. Probably the most prolific writer within our own community on the topic of Gnevas Das and its modern-day applications is Rabbi Aaron Levine, who wrote about this in pretty much every single one of the books that he published on economics and Jewish law. And there's a nice little article by a fellow named Heshi Friedman. I don't remember where I saw it. He talks about two different major categories of the definition of Gnevas Das. One is creating a false impression, that's deception, and the other is engendering undeserved goodwill. I would add a third, which is that there's an affirmative duty to disclose. Whenever there is a transaction in which one is involved, one is conveying something of value, and the other person might be under the misimpression it's worth more than it really is, and you know about a particular defect, so we don't have a principle in Jewish law of caveat emptor, buyer beware. It's seller beware. Beware that you not violate the prohibition of Geneva's Das. You have an affirmative obligation to disclose. That's mentioned by the Rambam, the Torah, and the Shulchan Aruch. The major sugyas of Geneva's Das are split into two different places. One is in Baba Metzia, Daf Nunches, the Daf Samach, which speak about the Mekach Umemka type of transactions, not to mix the bad with the good and present everything as all good or of a particular prototype when it's not really of that prototype. And how much do we allow of certain types of sediments in wine and things of that variety? And then you have the sugya in Chulin, Daf Sadi Dalid, that deals with what would be more examples, not necessarily of Mekach Umemker. Some of it is Mekach Umemker, but particularly of deception when it comes to non-Jews, being careful not to sell them a product that they think is all kosher and a shkuta when it really is a trefa and things of that variety. And also to not create false impressions or engender undeserved goodwill in just regular day-to-day interactions, what we might call devarim, types of cases which don't necessarily involve monetary transactions, but just goodwill, bialma. Somebody thinks that you went out to visit them, to greet them, and really you were just taking out the garbage, and they are, you know, just profoundly appreciative. But you have to say, oh, I'm sorry, I was just taking out the garbage. So that's the sugya in Chulin. Rambam packs it in two different places. Hilchos Mechira, he talks about Mekach Umemker cases, and in Hilchos Deos, he talks about more the types of Maseches Chulin cases for the most part that deal with correcting misapprehensions when it's supposed to be corrected as a matter of mitos or not. Is the Yisr Deraisa Drabbanan? It may depend on which aspect of Geneva's Das we're talking about. Are we talking about fooling somebody in a monetary transaction, or are we just talking about engendering undeserved goodwill in terms of day-to-day interactions where there's no money at stake? So maybe there's a nafka mina between those two different cases. That's how the Graz, the Shulchan Aruch Harab, reads the Rambam. He says that, the Rambam in Hilchos Mechira is telling you sort of the Deraisa applications in a Mekach Umemker context. You're not supposed to fool the customer into thinking they're getting more than what they're really getting. And the Rambam in Hilchos Deos is basically giving you the proper midos, the Midrash Sheker Tirchok type of applications that would relate to Geneva's Das. And those would be on a Drabbanan level. And the Rambam himself, you don't really have a clear sense that he's differentiating between one type of being Deraisa, the other type of being Drabbanan. But the other question that arises is to what degree does it apply to non-Jews? The Shmuel in Maseches Chulin says, also the Gnov Das Abir, Safilu Daito, Shalovi Kochavim. But that principle, if we're going to say that maybe we would differentiate between the different contexts, there's a question about that. The Rambam brings this statement of how it is relevant to both to Jews and to non-Jews, both in terms of how he codifies the halacha in Hilchos Mechira. He says, "Afilu gnov das habrios." He says, "Us l'ramos es bnei adam mekach umemker oligno v'staitam mechad ovi kocham mechad yisrael shavim b'davar zeh." And then he, not so conveniently for the Graz, does say at the end of that same halacha, "Afilu gnov das habrios b'dvarim aser." Even with respect to dvarim, he doesn't indicate that one is mochamen than the other, or that one is applicable to non-Jews and the other is not, and the other is not applicable to non-Jews. And in Hilchos Deos as well, the Rambam also says, also lignov das abios rafilu das das anachri, and then he brings examples of both mechira and dvarim there too. Ketzelo yimkol anachri bas nevelim makom bas shkuta. Don't sell them bas nevelim, claim or indicate that it's bas shkuta. And then he brings lo yeshahev b'chaveru shiochel etzlo yodeh sheino ochel. Then he brings personal interactions that don't have to do with mamonos, like inviting somebody for a meal the Gemara talks about, when you know the person is not going to accept the invitation. So some say no, but there he said b'chavero, see? So he started out talking about the non-Jew in the mechira context, and then when it came to devarim, so then he said b'chavero. That's weak, as Rav Asher Weiss writes in a particular essay, just using the lashon of how the halacha is originally brought, that it is talking about b'chaveiro, like when the Gemara talks about these cases, it uses a lashon of b'chaveiro, but it's not necessarily that the Rambam is changing his tune when he started the halacha speaking about non-Jews. So and similarly in Hilchos Mechira as well, when he says very clearly, Echad Aslo Ramos Bispnei Adam Olignov Zedaitam Echad Ovi Kachon Mechad Yisrael. The end of that sentence is Rabbi Olignov Dasabius Bedvarim Aser. So it seems like there wouldn't be any distinction in that regard, but there are poskim who draw a distinction in that regard, saying that it's only in a mechad type of transaction that there would be an iser of Geneva's Das when it comes to non-Jews. That's what the Shach says. I think I have that in the materials, in source Yud Zayin, in Simen Kuf Yud Zayin, Sif Aleph, where he says that B'matana Mutter, that there would be, when with respect to Naovi Kochavim, maybe Matana Mishum Geneva's Das. That seems to be a Deya, which is suggested at least in the Tosfos and Daf Tzadi Dalet and Mebeisa Maseches Shulin and Rabbeinu Machlokes, between some of the Bali Tosfos on the one hand and Rabbeinu Tam, it would seem to hold that it would be Yasser. The Rambam seems to hold that it is an Isser with respect to non-Jews as well, at least the Rabbanan, and no reason to assume in the simple reading of the Rambam that if every other part of Geneva's Das is Deraisa, that this wouldn't be Deraisa as well. The Bach also seems to have that approach of the Shach, if you look in the Bach here in Simen Reish Chav Ches. But again, that's a question mark that I think is difficult to read within the Rambam. But if you would say that there is this distinction that the Graz says between the Raisas and the Rabbanans, as to if it's Mekach U'Memker, then the Yis is the Raisa, and if it's something less than Mekach U'Memker, like just a Matana situation, somebody thinks they're getting more than what they really are getting, if that's only the Rabbanan, so then we can understand that maybe there might be more of a room to distinguish between a Yisrael and a Nakum with respect to anything which is not going to be on a Daraisa level, and say that maybe the Yis that Shmuel was talking about is only when I'm dealing with the Daraisa level. The Sforno says that Geneva's Das is included in the Aseres HaDibros. So with the Sforno, if you look in Yisrael, under Lo Signov, he says, B'chal Geneva, Geneva's Nefashos, Geneva's Mamon, U'Geneva's Das Abrios. He says, Geneva's Das Abrios, at least on some level, there is a Daraisa application of Geneva's Das Abrios. The Smag also indicates that it is an Isser, that it is an Isser de Araisa. So again, maybe whether it's the Araisa de Rabbanan would indicate if it's the Rabbanan, there's more room b'sapek to be Mako, maybe with an Akum more room to be Mako. The Pashtus is that it applies across the board. Now, we mentioned the three dimensions to the Isser. There really are four. There really are four, because one of them has two different dimensions. So first of all, there's the Mekach U'Memker cases above a Metzia, where you're mamish fooling the purchaser. You're charging a greater price based upon saying that all of your merchandise is very, very good. But in reality, you're giving some merchandise that, like Peiros Chadashim and Peiros Yishanim, that is not as good, and you're charging the higher price. So that for sure is going to be a very serious issue. Says the Prisha, I don't understand. Why do I have a separate simon over here to tell me that this is going to be an Issa of Geneva's Das? It's an Issa of Geneva. It's an Issa. We just had the simon on Onah. You're going to overcharge somebody for something. So we already said you're not allowed to overcharge somebody for something. So he says, no, it means you'll get an additional patch. You're violating an additional Issa. Then he gives two other answers. He says there's a Shir Onah, that the owner, that the transaction is not rescinded if you charge less than 1/6 extra. Then it is considered to be mechila. But you are going to have an issue of Geneva's Das if you fooled somebody into thinking that you had merchandise that was worth the greater amount, even though it was less than 1/6 more. And really, you had stuck in a few bad apples together in your apple collection, and that's why you charged the higher price. So that's why you need a separate, special, standalone Isser, even though normally from the standpoint of Onah, we say, oh, but there's Mechila with that amount. We say, no, but you violated the Isser of Geneva's Das. What? Three answers. The first answer I gave already, and the second answer I gave. First answer is you violated an Isser. Maybe you've overcharged by more than a sixth. You violated an Isser. But you violate another Isser. You violate another Isser. Like for example, you do an Avla to somebody. So lo sasu Avel. So now you violated an additional Isser. An Isser Gnevas Das. The second one is that even that in the event that you didn't, let's say it wasn't a violation of Onah per se. Let's say you were allowed to charge, you know, or there'll be mechila if you charge less than 1/6 more, but you still, if it was based upon fooling the person into thinking that it was all good apples and you put in a few bad apples, so you've also violated Gnevas Das. And then there's a third answer that he gives. The third answer that he gives is that even if you didn't overcharge at all, even if you didn't overcharge at all, nonetheless, there still is Gnevas Das. The person thinks that they're getting a good deal, that they think that it's all good apples. But it happens, you threw in a few bad apples, and you said, if it would be all good apples, I charge you $20. I'm only going to charge you $18. I'm giving you a great deal. But really, you threw in a few bad apples. So they thought they were getting, you know, a bargain deal, but instead they were just getting the price. They were getting the actual. So you didn't steal them, though. You didn't overcharge them, but you incurred undeserved goodwill in terms of giving the person what they thought was a bargain. Like the Gemara in Chulin talks about that you're not supposed to sell a shoe, right? A shoe of a behemo yimka adam lachaveo sandal shemesa b'chlal shel shachaya shkuta. That you shouldn't sell a shoe which is made from a dead animal instead of, and you're representing that it came from an animal that was properly shechted. Why is it? Because it's Gnevas Das. And number two, the skin of a dead animal that died on its own, as opposed to being shechted, is going to potentially be poisonous. But leaving aside even the poisonous consideration, let's assume the person doesn't die. It doesn't turn out to be poisonous, but still says the Gemara, it's Gnevas Das. So the question, so we say, Shemateu, the Maharsha, on that sugya says that I don't understand. In this particular case, why do you have to tell me that it's also Mishmei Shemateu? Because he's tricking him. Tell me that it's also because it's Ona, because the price that you're going to charge for a shkuta is going to be much more than the price that you would sell for an Avela, because the skin, the quality of the leather is not going to be as good. It's not going to be as strong as a healthy animal that got shechted and didn't just die on its own. It says, V'yesh Lomar, Demayri, Kigon Shumachalo Osan Bizol, Kigon Shel Kemoshel Meso. Talking about, this is the scenario that the Smad discusses in the Prisha, where you may have sold the item for what it really was worth. But the person thought that they're getting themselves a tremendous bargain. And therefore, it's usur, not because you're violating Gezela, not because you're violating Onah. It's usur because you are causing the person to be maksik lo tova. You're causing the person to be maksik tova, and it was not warranted for the person to be maksik tova. So that would be all included in the in different scenarios of Mecha Chumemka. So there are two cases of Mecha Chumemka that really are discussed in the Gemara. One is we are overcharging, and there's an additional Gnevas Das, because not only did you overcharge, we also tricked the person as the nature of the merchandise. Second is you didn't overcharge, but you tricked the person into as the nature of the merchandise, despite the fact that you didn't overcharge. Maybe the person thought they were getting a really good bargain, and they weren't getting a good bargain. You sold them the Mona Lisa for $100. They thought, wow, I'm getting the steal of the century. But really, the person drew it on in their own, and it's not really the Mona Lisa. So it really was worth only $100 if I drew the Mona Lisa. I mean, if the guy thought it looked like the Mona Lisa, maybe it should be worth more. But nonetheless, you charge whatever was the actual price, and it wasn't what the person thought that they were getting. But then you have this whole separate category of what we call Devarim Alone. Devarim Alone are all of these categories. Ayisari Badam Lachaveru Lisod Etzlo. A person shouldn't entreat their fellow, oh, I want you to come for Shabbos lunch. They know this person never eats out anywhere. Or the person, or you have the case where you open up the barrel for a guest. You're not engaged in a monetary transaction. I'm giving some wine to a guest. And the guest thinks, oh, wow, I must be really special because opening up a whole barrel. When you open up the barrel, the wine starts to go bad. So you open up a new barrel for somebody stopping by. give them a little bit of wine. That's like the biggest honor in the world. I mean, the olden days. I mean, we don't really have, you know, barrels of wine sitting around anymore in our houses. But, you know, you can figure out some other, you open up like a really fancy bottle of wine. But the truth of the matter is that this wine had already been consigned to the local merchant. And therefore, you're giving it away to the merchant anyway. You really shouldn't take out some wine if you consign the barrel to the merchant. All right, you'll deduct the price of, you know, whatever wine was given out right now. But the person thinks that you're giving them a tremendous honor. This is engendering undeserved goodwill. That's how Rashi says, "V'nim samaksik lo tov achinam." Maksik lo person tov achinam. That's the big problem over here, says Rashi. So that's case number three. Really, so first case is Mecha Chomemka, which has two forms. You're overcharging and not overcharging. The second case, or we'll call it the third case, is it's Dvarim Bi'alma. It's nothing to do with Mecha Chomemka. It's just undeserved goodwill and regular interpersonal interactions. And then the fourth inyan is really the one that's introduced by the Rambam, Torah, Shulchan Aruch. They all talk about there's an affirmative obligation of disclosure. So that's sort of the last part of the equation. You find that in the Rambam, Hilchos Mechira, Perek Yuches, Halacha Aleph, Haya Yodea, Sheyesh B'Memker Mum, Yodio L'Lokeach. You know that your Memker has a Mum, has a blemish. You must inform the purchaser. Afilu Lignav Das Abius B'Dvar Maso. This is also an extension of Gnevas Das B'Dvarim. It's not only that you are obligated not to create a false impression affirmatively, but you have to dispel a false impression that happens to be out there by pointing out that what you're doing is not what the person thinks, or what they're getting is not necessarily what they think. So there's a very nice story in the very first volume of the Magid Speaks, right? You're familiar with this series. The first volume of the Magid Speaks was was an actual Magid that Rabbi Krohn was writing about, with Shlomo Shwadron, who was a great Magid of Jerusalem. And he told the story of Rav Eliyahu Cohen Dishnitzer, who was one of the Lamed Vav Nikar Tzadikim, according to the Chazon Ish. And he had an orchard, I think in Bnei Brak, an orchard. He was selling the orchard, and he could never sell the orchard to anybody because he would always point out all the defects. So finally, they just couldn't get him to keep his mouth shut about all the defects of his orchard. He really needed the money. So really trying to help this. So they finally, some American person said, "I'll buy it. I don't care about all the defects." So he said, "Oh, but I don't know. You're in America." Gemara Mesiyah Daf Chotes Amud Bei says that if you can't supervise the workers, so you shouldn't really buy something because it's not going to be properly maintained if you're not there on the premises. He said, "Don't worry. I'm perfectly okay with that. I'm the Kabbalah. I understand all the challenges. I'll work it out. I have agents. I have friends over here. I messenger. We'll work it out." And then he says, "Oh, but there are some of the trees that really don't do very well, and they're very weak, and they're dying, and I have to show you all these trees." They said, "Oh, it's okay. I'll buy it anyway." And then everyone's so excited. It looks like he's finally going to complete the sale. He's finally going to get some money. He's finally going to agree to sell the orchard to somebody. And then last minute, this American businessman takes out like a little pill from his pocket and swallows it. He says, "Oh, what's going on here? What's that pill? Why are you swallowing the pill?" And he says, "Oh, that's okay. I just have to take this pill every day or so for my, you know, for my heart. It's just heart medication." He says, "Heart medication? Oh boy, oh boy. I'm not selling this orchard to you because there's so much agmas nefesh from this orchard that it's going to be perilous to your health. I can't do that to you." So that's, you know, that's a Jewish businessman, you know. So this is what it means to have, you know, proper midos. This entire siman in Shulchan Aruch is all about, rather than sort of the secular notion, which is that you figure out how to give a person enough rope to hang themselves. So in halacha, we believe that you have to be 100% above board in every single way. Now, there are at least four different explanations that are given for the Yisr. One is simply, it's Geneva. Like we mentioned before, Lo Tignov, the Sforno says this is Geneva. The Tosefta says explicitly there are seven forms of a Geneva. And this one is considered to be the absolute worst of the seven different forms of a Geneva. When you're dealing with Geneva's Das. Tosefta Baba Kama Perek Zayin. Halacha hey. I'm sorry, three forms. Shlosha Ganavim Hayim and Gadol Shebekulam Gonev Das Abrius. The Ritva gives this explanation. It's very fascinating as to why it is that Ganeva's Das applies to an Akum, even if you wouldn't hold it by Ganeva's Akum in general. He says that this definitely applies to an Akum. Why is that? Because when the Torah says this principle of lo tignovu, so it says lo tignovu lo tichachshu v'lo tishakaru ish pami. So there's an esnachta. This is one of the early drushes of Rishonim on the Tamei Hamikra. The Ritva says this is an esnachta lo tignovu lo tichachshu v'lo tishakaru ish pami. So since it's an esnachta under lo signovu, that means that it has nothing to do with ish bamiso. Lo signovu across the board. Presumably any gnevus of Akka would be also according to him. But certainly he says lo signovu to the extent that that includes gnevus das. That's what he assumes, that it includes gnevus das. So he says this is how we know that it would apply to a non-Jew as well. So he seems to indicate that it is included within just a general list of gneva. Rabbeinu Yonah in the Shari Shuva, Shari Gimel, Simen Kof Pei Dalet, says, you know what the nature of the Isser is? The nature of the Isser is non one of Sheker, because he includes this in his general discussion regarding Sheker. He says, according to Gemara, it's more chomer than Gezel and Nochri, which might not be on the same level, Dereis or whatever. Because of the fact that a lying tongue is considered to be a terrible transgression, our trademark is supposed to be emes. It's one of the foundations of the soul, and therefore that's why he says it will be also for a Nochri as well. The same, perhaps, you know, explanation that the Minchas Chinuch gives as to why I might distinguish between Gnevas Akum being also and not Gezelus Akum, because Gezelus Akum, okay, so that it's not nice to take something from somebody, but Gneva, you're stealthily stealing from somebody when they don't notice. So that's something which is not just an offense between you and your fellow man, but that's a stain on your soul. That is a stain upon your midos. So here too, that's what he says. It's a stain. Gnevas Das, that's a stain upon your midos. That's maybe why we call it Gnevas Das, not Gezelus Das. Gnevas Das, it's something which has to do with your internal midos. And therefore, that's the reason why it would be usher with respect to an Akum as well. Rav Asher Weiss says that he thinks, according to the Rambam, third explanation that we started with. He says, look at the Rambam. The Rambam is very careful where he puts things. He had a lot of room in Hilchos Geneva and Hilchos Gezela to plop in Geneva's Das anywhere that he wanted, whether in a Mechiva context or a Dvarim context, but he chose not to do that. He has a little bit in Hilchos Deis, but then where else does he have it? He has it in Hilchos Mechira, Perek Yerches, Hilchos Mechira. What does that have to do with Geneva? I'll tell you what you do include in Hilchos Mechira. You include laws of Onah and Mechach Tos. That would be included in Hilchos Mechira. So he says it's an outgrowth of Onah. That's what he thinks. And then he says that since the Rambam also has it in Hilchos Deis, so we see that there's an aspect of Geneva's Adas as well, which is included in basically Midos. You could say that's sort of an overlap of Rabbeinu Yonah saying that it's in the realm of Sheker, but even if it wouldn't be considered outright Sheker per se, so it's what we call Orchos Yosher. It's considered to be just proper behavior. It's where the Rambam has the Lashon in Hilchos Deos, where he says that even if there's one, Afidu Mila Achas Shopito Vishel Gnevas Das, even one word of sweet talk or misleading impressions would be also a spas emes ruach nachon v'leiv tov mikol amo v'havus. He says, but a person is supposed to have ruach nachon kadesh v'kirbi. He's a leiv tahor v'ravli elokim. They got this straight out of the Rambam, the whole song. He says that this is what you're supposed to have. You're supposed to have a leiv tahor ruach nachon. It's not only about sheker. It's about it's about the essence of your midos, the essence of your personality. So there may be some nafkaminas between the reasons that you would give to this, and that would be sort of what kind of a deception are we talking about that would be problematic. There's a question, appears to be a machlokas Rashi and Tosus, Dav Tzadi Dalin Amun Aleph, from the various questions, somebody opening up the barrel and so forth, as to whether you need for the person to say explicitly that they are opening the barrel for them, right? That's what Rashi seems to indicate. He says, "Kishomalo bishvilcha ani poskan." I'm opening it. The person says, "I'm opening up for you." And Tosfos says he doesn't think so, especially from the story of Rav Yehuda and Ula, where Rav Yehuda didn't open it up for Ula, who was his guest. it's hard to believe Rabbi Yehuda would have said, I'm opening it up for you if it wasn't Jews. He says, nah. He thinks that it's just that sometimes it creates a certain mistaken impression. So Rav Aaron Levine says, maybe this machlokas Rashi and Tosfos, as to whether it has to be sort of intentional or not, if that's how you understand the machlokas, would depend on what the reasoning would be. If the reasoning would be geneva, so geneva is something that would presumably have to be carried out with a certain amount of intentionality, he says. Otherwise, you know, it's a mistake. Something came into your possession, mistake, like geneva, but it still would be a sheker concern. It still would be a sheker concern, even if there's no intentionality to it. Now, Rav Asher Weiss says that he thinks, even according to Tosfos, the only distinction is that you don't have to open up your mouth and say, I'm doing it for you in order for it to be a problem, but there still has to be a certain measure of intentionality. And he reads that into both the Rambam and the Shulchan Aruch, because the Rambam codifies this case in Hilchos Deos, Perek Beis Halacha Vav. He says, "V'lo yiftach lo chavio shitzarak leposachan lemochran." Shouldn't open up a barrel of wine that was already consigned to the dealer. Kidei lefatoso shebishvil kibodo pasach, in order to flatter the individual to think that you're opening up him. So kidei lefatoso. So you got to read the words of the Rambam. Kidei lefatoso sounds like there is some intentionality. So well, that didn't make its way into the Shulchan Aruch. But is that true that it didn't make its way into the Shulchan Aruch? The Shulchan Aruch also says. Lo yiftach chavios ha psuchos lechenvani v'zeh sover shepascham bishvilo elatzarech lehodio shelo pascham bishvilo. So from the Shulchan Aruch, it's not quite as muchlach. Where he says lo yiftach chavios psuchos lechenvani, sounds like you could have just opened it without necessarily indicating that you're trying to do it for him. That's a question. But certainly within the Rambam, he tries to read it within the Shulchan Aruch as well. The Rambam's lashon seems to be that there is a certain amount of intentionality. So that might be, according to Rav Aaron Levine, that might be a distinction between the two opinions. As to whether you say, at least the first two opinions, as to whether it's an Isser Geneva or whether it's an Isser Sheker. So this also runs to the question of unwarranted assumptions. When are you obligated to disabuse a person of unreasonable inferences? So Tosos distinguishes between different cases. And Tosos says that we have the case of Rav Yehuda and Ula, where Rav Yehuda opened up a wine barrel for Ula, and the question is, how could he have done so when the wine barrel had already been consigned to the merchants? There are two answers that the Gemara gives. One answer is, he did tell him. One answer is that Rav Yehuda told Ula, don't worry, he told him. And the other answer is that Rav Yehuda would have opened it up for Ula anyway. That's the other answer. That answer doesn't get recorded in the Rambam, it doesn't get recorded in the Torah, it doesn't get recorded in the Shulchan Aruch. The question is, do we not hold by that answer la-maisa? The Sma quotes it. The Beis Yosef says, yeah, kind of obvious that would be true. So obvious. Why do you need to say it? You know? So the Beis Yosef followed his own advice and he didn't say it when he codified in the Shulchan Aruch. Because it's obvious. The Rabbin didn't feel a need to say it. So why should I feel a need to say it? But that's a question mark. The other case that the Gemara talks about, where it gives sort of a different approach, was when Marzutra was walking on his path. And he is traveling from one place to, he's traveling from one place to another. He's traveling from Misichara to Bay Mechuza. And Rav and Rav Safra are coming from to Sichra. And on their way to Sifra, to Sichra, they meet Marzutra, who's coming from Sichra to go towards Bay Mechuza. So who's Saval Api Hutakasu? So he thought, oh, that's so nice, my welcoming party. He says, oh, come on, shucks, guys. You didn't have to come all the way out to greet me. That was so kind of you that you shouldn't have. And Safa said, not only shouldn't we have, but we didn't. I don't know how you did in the Kasi Mar. We didn't know you were coming. But had we known you were coming, then we sure would have gone out, with bells and whistles to greet you. Of course, ticker tape parade. We would have done much more for you had we known. So he followed that sort of approach, but he had to say it. He didn't simply rely upon the fact that maybe, you know, it should, that he would have done it anyway, but he corrected the misimpression that Marzutra had. And he said, we would have done more. And Rava said, my time on Mislehachi, Dakashi Sevli Daite. Rava throws in a new consideration here, a new consideration, a new factor, and part of the discussion that makes a lot of sense if we understand that this is all about Onah, in terms of Onah's Dvarim, or all about Midos, which is that you don't want to cause Agmas Nefesh to the other person. If the whole nature of the Isser, on some level, of Gnevas Das, particularly when there is no ruse or cheating going on when it comes to a monetary transaction, is just that you don't want to make a person feel bad because it's bad for your Midos, and it's also Onah's Dvarim from their perspective. So then you also have to take into account there may be too much disclosure when a person has an unwarranted assumption is going to cause that person agmas nefesh, and therefore would be the wrong thing to do. So says the Gemara, no, v'hakamatinenle, but you're still not allowed to mislead the person. So the Gemara says, no, here we have a consideration of iu de kamati nafshe. So we can understand the dialogue like this, that maybe all of these considerations are true. Onas Dvarim is a consideration. With respect to Onas Dvarim, we don't want to call the person, cause the person Agmas Nefesh. Ay, Vakamatinale. But we still have to keep our Midos intact. Our Midos have to remain strong. So it's not good for our Midos if we're going to mislead the person. So therefore, we still have that as a separate consideration. We say, no, we don't have that as a separate consideration when the person really should have known better. There's no good reason why Marzutra should have assumed because he's outside and we're outside, and there was no announcement in the paper necessarily that he's coming from Sichra to Bei Mechuza, they would go out and greet him. So because it was an unwarranted assumption, they, according to Rav, and this is the way we paskin, they had no obligation to correct his unwarranted assumption. So says Tosfos in Chulin on Daf Tzadi Dalet Amud Beis. So Tosfos says wait a second. What about the question? He says that the question is that Hakamatinan lay. So Rabbi Yosef, Rabbi Safra had said, we would have gone out anyway to greet you. So why isn't that similar to the case that we had before with respect to Rabbi Yehuda and Ula? When Ula came as a guest to Rabbi Yehuda was allowed, according to the second Teretz, to say, yeah, I would have done it anyway. So why is it considered to be Matinan lay? So we say, no. There's a difference between the cases. Because objectively speaking, when Rabbi Yehuda opened up the barrel of wine for Ula, he was opening up the barrel of wine for Ula. It's true that it had already been consigned to a local merchant, but he was doing it for the sake of Ula. They were not, however, going out on the road for the purpose of greeting Ma'ukva, and therefore this falls into a different category. That's the explanation that is given by Tosos. It's an important explanation because, as we'll see, not everybody seems to necessarily follow that that explanation. We might say that Rav Safra in this particular case, why didn't he say like Ulo that we don't want to cause the person undue stress, given the fact that there was an unwarranted assumption that was made over here. So says in the Sefer Nivs Fasayim that we have a little bit of insight about the answer to that from a story which is in Maseches Derech Eretz. It's a story in Maseches Derech Eretz that tells a separate story of Rav Safra. Rav Safra goes out, and Rav Safra is, and there's a chassid echad. He's a chassid, chassidus shepel. So he is walking into town, and Rav Safra went out to take a little spatzir, to take a little walk at the time. And this chassid said, wow, I can't believe it. The great Rav Safra went to greet me. Can I believe it? That's the most incredible thing. I'm the happiest person in the world today. You've made my day. You've made my year. I cannot believe, Rav Safra, that you yourself, Kvodo Ve'atzmo, wow, Rav Safra came out to greet me. And he's like dancing along and singing. And he's just like, I mean, you can imagine. The chassidus shepel is like a hofer begin over the fact that Rav Safra went out to greet this guy. And Rav Safa completely deflates his balloon. Rav Safa just, you know, just puts a pin in the balloon and deflates all the air. He says, what are you talking about? Lo yitzasi el letayel. I just went out to take a walk. And now the guy is just completely deflated. The guy is just crushed. And the Tamidim of Rav Safa turn into Rav Safa, and they say, how could you have caused this poor fellow so much agmas nefesh? Did you really have to tell him? It wasn't really a warranted assumption anyway. You weren't obligated to correct him. And Rav Safa said, didn't you read like all the Gemaras about like who is considered to be like the essence of Adova Emes Bavovo? That's me, Rav Safa. I'm like the guy in all those stories. I'm Adova Emes Bavovo. So everybody knows that about me. And therefore, if there is, you know, any kind of a shemitz, a possibility that I'm doing something that is not 100% emistix, that somebody makes it clear that they think that I did something and I didn't really do it, that I had a certain intention, I didn't really have that intention. If I don't say anything, then they're going to 100% assume that it is really the case, as they're saying, even if it is an unwarranted assumption. Rava apparently, as the Sefer Nivsusayim says, felt that Apal Pikein, because of the fact that it was so incredibly unwarranted, even in Rav Safa's case, he felt that it wasn't necessary to correct it. But we could say that maybe that's Rav Safa's svara. That Rav Safa, that here there is sort of a subjective element that is thrown into the mix of what is sort of the subjective expectation somebody would have of this individual. If they would make a statement that would be unwarranted, if this is a person that would always want everything to be 100% core and 100% pristine in terms of how they are understood in every single way, and they're like a Gadol Ador, you have a Yaakov Kamenetsky and Emes Yaakov kind of personality, somebody like that. So maybe then, maybe, it's not codified in Shulchan Aruch, but it could be, that maybe there really is a different standard, you know, with respect to that individual. But otherwise, as Rav Levine says, it's less embarrassing when a person will sort of discover on their own and realize that they had made an unwarranted assumption. Therefore, that's the way that it's supposed to be left. Interestingly, the Ben Yehoyada says that they actually accompanied him at that point in time. The Ben Yehoyada says that Rava and Rav Safa didn't accompany Marzutra all the way to Bei Mechuza. So not that they were trying to mislead him, but because it really was true that they did want to honor him. So once it turned out that they met him along the way, so they did in fact honor him. And that's important as well, because even according to the way that we paskin like Rava, that you don't have to correct the mistaken impression, so to speak. So built into that equation is that there still is a certain amount of goodwill that is truthful. That is the reason that one of the reasons that you don't need to correct it. If they would just go along their merry way, so then it's very clear that they didn't just go out to greet him. So you know, then you wouldn't need the sugya altogether. But the fact of the matter is that the reason why they wouldn't need to correct him is because what they do is consistent with his general assumption. So you have this type of dilemma in a number of different contexts. Like you have wedding guest dilemma. You know, somebody comes, I made a simcha, right? Married off my son. Somebody comes to the wedding all the way from Chicago, and I'm so excited. I say, wow, you know, I'm so excited you came all this way. It turns out they were really there primarily because of the other side. They're very, very close to the other side. So it's their obligation to say to me, oh, I was only there for the other side. Fortunately, I didn't say to them, I'm so happy you came all this way just for me. I just say, I'm happy to see you. So they didn't have to say anything. I'm happy to see you. But if I would have said, I only found out later with respect to one particular person, because somebody came to me a couple of months later. Yeah, sure. I understood why they were there, because, you know, they go to, you know, your son's, you know, grandfather-in-law's, Tapiomi Shir in Chicago. So of course, they're very close to that family. So of course he was there at the wedding. So, you know, I felt, oh my goodness, I thought they came for me. Maybe they'd come for me. I don't know. But if you would have that type of situation, so that comes up from time to time. Or you have an honoree at a dinner dilemma. Like I went to a Karen Biavna dinner a number of years ago, and one of the honorees was one of our Rosh Hashanah. I had no idea who was being honored. Somebody asked me to go to the dinner. So I went to the dinner. And this fellow walks over to me and says, oh, thank you so much for coming to honor me, because he was one of the honorees. It was my obligation to say, I didn't really come to honor. I had no idea you were being honored. I mean, I'm happy you're being honored, because I'm happy to be there anyway. But he said, do I have an obligation, an affirmative obligation, based on this whole story of the Marzutra? Do we say that no, it's an unwarranted assumption on his part? But it's an unwarranted assumption. If I'm walking on the street and taking out my garbage, or taking a walk on a Shabbos afternoon, but it might not be an unwarranted assumption if I actually come to the dinner at which he's being honored. So this is so there are many different scenarios. So the Shulchan Aruch does build in another consideration. So one consideration was that you don't want to cause a person embarrassment. Another is that you want to cause the person kavod. This is from the Gemara, but it's codified in Shulchan Aruch. Don't say to somebody, oh, I'm going to smear some oil for yourself from this flask, but there's really no oil in it, but you just know the person's not going to take you up on your offer. Don't walk into a base oval with a jug that supposedly has wine in order to console the mourners. But if it's for purposes of being mechabed, so then that would be permissible. And the indication from the Gemara is that if I have a chaver ear, and though this doesn't really get codified in the Shulchan Aruch, yesham chaver ear mutter, but the idea of chaver ear is that if you're being mechabed the person because there are also other people around. And it's a kavod that you're there because that you're there and you're showing kavod when there are other people around. There's more reason not to burst the bubble, so to speak, when there are other people who are present. And that, in fact, is mentioned explicitly when we speak about this idea of kavod. It's mentioned explicitly by the Sma, because in the context of not inviting a person when you know that they're not going to come. So the Sma says, the Bach also has this. The Sma says, yeah, but that doesn't mean that you don't invite them at all. There's a certain amount that's just considered to be derech eretz. Well, yapsibo, you shouldn't be all gushy about it, and you shouldn't be persistent as if like this is something that you're desperate to do when you know the person is going to say no. But if you're not being mafsibo, ladabibo pamachas ustayibo achalimi, but to say once or twice to somebody, come and eat with me, so that's just derech eretz. That's just the book of etiquette, how you're supposed to behave, that you say, hi, how are you? Do I really care how you are? I mean, I care to have like a good relationship with you. But you say the words, hi, how are you? Without necessarily thinking about, you know, what you're saying, that you would stay around and listen to the answer. But it's the same idea. So there's a certain protocol, derech eretz, that you say, oh, I'd love to have you over for lunch sometime, bye. Ki adaraba imlo yidabi imo kein. Because if you didn't say that to the person, he's going to be embarrassed to harrow him. Because the other people around will say, oh, he's not worthy of an invitation from you. So there's a difference. The Sma says that the Aruch HaShulchan also has this as well. There's one authority, Chaim David Alevi, who seems to say, oh, no, it's not, the Chavi Yir idea is not brought Lalacha Suna home by it. But no, you see from the Sma, we do really hold by this Chavi Yir that there's a difference to the degree that you have other people around. And you have to take that into account as well. Person says, thank you so much for coming and honoring the dinner, and there are 10 people standing there. It may not be the time for you to say, oh, well, actually, I had no idea that you were being honored. Hey, I knew you were being honored. I would have come anyway. It's just, you don't necessarily need to give that entire spiel, especially if it's not a conversation only between yourself and that person. So Avosha Weiss says, in the wedding case, so he talks about this wedding case where you say, oh, thank you so much for coming to our wedding, for making, you know, person flies, let's say, from Chicago to Brooklyn. So, wow, it really looks like they made a special effort. So do you have to, if you're the guest, say, well, the truth of the matter is, I came primarily because of the other side. So Avosha Weiss says, first of all, his reading of the Rambam and his reading of the Shulchan Aruch, though that seems a little less muchach, is that you need kavanah in all of these cases. So certainly, there was no kavana when you showed up to the wedding that you wanted this person to think that you were coming there to honor them per se. No, you wanted to join the wedding. You're happy that that you know both sides, but you were there primarily for the other side. Secondly, going back to the story of Marzutra and Rav and Rav Safra, on the other hand, the person who came to who was one side of the wedding should have realized the possibility that maybe you were there because of the other side. And the third consideration that he says is mipnei kevodo, In order to not cause the person, you know, embarrassment. So, you know, that would be the cover that you would show. And he says that maybe that's only when there are roim. Maybe that's only when there are other people who are around as well. And I thought in my case, where the person came over to me and said, thank you so much for coming to honor me at this dinner, that's probably what he said to everybody. Like, you know, how socially savvy is anybody who's going to be honored at a dinner? Like, if you figure out, like a pat line, you're going to say to everybody that you see, and it doesn't matter who like shows up. It's just the person comes to collect stucco. You say, oh, thank you so much for showing up to honor me. Because you just have your line that you're going to say the entire night. So the person said, he's not implying that, oh, yeah, I really think that you came for me. No, that's just like what he's saying. Just like those are the words that come out of his mouth. So I don't think that it's my job to say, oh, well, actually, I didn't really come specifically to honor you. Somebody asked me to come to the day. He didn't really ask me. He's not assuming anything just because he says that particular line. It's a bigger dilemma when I'm in town. When I'm in town in New York, in New York for one of my monthly YU trips, and, you know, in the Sugar Dock, somebody, you know, became an Ovil, and I go to be Menachem Ovil to them. And then I walk into the room. You say, oh, Rabbi Reese, all the way from Chicago, you know? So is it my job? Is it appropriate, you know, at that point in time to say, well, actually, I was here for my monthly YU trip, but, you know, of course, I would want to come anyway. Well, I don't know anyway. If I would have flown in for Chicago, like, you know, maybe in one or two cases, I would have thought about it, but, you know, I can't say for sure I would have done it. What? Okay, right, but I don't think that there was that implication that anybody said. But if you're in that type of predicament, so one thing that can is you look at the people in question and you say to yourself, is it reasonable for them to have thought that I came just for them? If it's the sort of person or a family, like within the YU universe, where they know that I come in all the time to Gishurim every single month, so then it's not necessarily a reasonable inference that I would have come in from Chicago just for them. So somebody would know that I do come in from time to time. So I don't think that you necessarily have to say anything under those circumstances. Plus, if you have 25 people who are sitting around at the time to say at that particular moment, oh, actually, I happen to be in town anyway, I don't know. I mean, I'll ask. I think it's a tough call.
We will have these calls.
It's a tough, tough call, you know, under those circumstances. But you do have these considerations, and certainly not the kavana for anybody to think, oh, I came in, you know, from Chicago specifically for this purpose. So those are tough situations. But one thing that Rabbi Levine does say, Rabbi Levine says that when we say kavod, the kavod has to be the other person's kavod. It can't be kavod like for my kavod, you know, not to say my kavod. It has to be only to save the other person's kavod under the circumstances. So and then you have what about what Rav Safra actually said? Oh yes, Ike. You're saying that according to Rav Asher Weiss, why do I need, in that case of Marzutra, why do I need the fact that it was an unwarranted assumption when Lemaise said there was no kavana on their part? Unless they're going to say that once they, you know, what once they greeted him, so then they had the kavana at that moment in time when they saw him. So, oh, here's a Mazut, let's go up and say hello to him. You know, it'd have to be like that sort of situation. I think it's very shver. I think it's very shver to say that svara. I think so. Although his deed from the Rambam is not a bad deed. His deed from the Rambam is not a bad deed because he does say kedela fatoso. Yeah. In a chinami. But I thought it was a chiddush that's worth mentioning. When he had a diuk from the Shulchan Aruch, I thought there was a diuk from the Shulchan Aruch too. I thought it was the Ftoach Lo, but now that I look in the Shulchan Aruch, it doesn't say the Ftoach Lo, so I'm going to take a look if I can find it at his essay, but I can't find it the second, so when I do find it, I will take a look and see again. Okay, so now getting back to Rav Safra's comment.
One more question.
Yes, sure.
If you
don't mind. No, not at all. It's good.
I hear it. Is there any weed in the colleague in these kind of, you know, situations that you're talking about between whether there's some potential like monetary benefit to you from that relationship versus like it being like purely social? I mean, meaning, like, there's a lot of this, right? Whether it's officially Gneva or, you know, check here, but saying, I mean, obviously it's much more serious to, like, lie when you have, even within Sheker, right? It's much more serious to lie when you have actual monetary benefit versus, like, purely social.
Yes, yes. And this is what we said, that when there is a monetary benefit that you are getting, so then it could be that it's a higher level issue. If, like, an even like, if somebody is going to give you more money for what it is that you're doing, so then because of the false impression that you're engendering, so that could be like Gnevas Mamon Mamish. That could be Gnevas Mamon Mamish. And we'll see that in some of the later tshuvos also regarding cheating on exams. Cheating on exams where there may be a nafkamina as to whether you're cheating on the exam in order to get a job that you don't deserve, where you're actually going to end up getting money for it. So that might really be Gnevas Mamon from somebody, as opposed to where it's just going to be covered biyama. You're just going to get a diploma. So the Menashe Klein in Mishnah Halacha says that if you're going to, you know, college, chas v'shalom, and then you cheat on an exam, if you're really just doing it for the kavod of getting a diploma, so then it's only considered to be gnevas das bedvarim, ulai apilu pachos mizeh, whatever in the world that means. And then he says however, in the event that the person is looking to get an actual job, you're really causing a person loss of money, because if you wouldn't have done well in the job, on the test, maybe you wouldn't have gotten the job. Or maybe instead of getting paid $15,000, they would have only paid you $10,000. If you're, for example, you'd be an accountant. So, you know, for a mediocre accountant, you'll pay, less of a salary. And if the person is going to be an engineer, so then they wouldn't pay you anything, he says, because, you know, if you don't know what you're doing as an engineer, mediocre engineer is worthless. He assumes a mediocre accountant is worth something, but a mediocre engineer would be absolutely worthless. And he says, so then they're not going to pay you anything. Then it definitely would make a difference. Like, here's what's his deal. Okay, thank you. They're giving me the opportunity to look again. So Rav Asher Weiss's deal was that when he rattles off all the cases, when the Shulchan Aruch rattles off all the cases in Siman Reish Kof Ches Siv Vav, so he says, "V'af lignom das abrius b'dvarim shemare she'ose b'shvilo ve'eno ose aser." Where you mare that you're doing it for the person, but you're not really doing it for the person. It's aser. And then he has ketzad. And then he rattles off all the cases. So he says that since all the cases were preceded by this line, so that was his deal. No, he's always, good to the task. He's able to buttress his points. He's able to agree or disagree, but he's very good at, bringing, good riots for his position. Okay, so now, with respect, the Tosos had brought the question about, what about Rabbi Yehuda's self-assessment? He would have opened up the barrel for Ula anyway. We said, well, it's not Paskin and Shulchan Aruch, but the Beis Yosef says it's obvious, and the Sma also seems to quote that without challenging that proposition. However, it's not necessarily the case that everybody agrees. There's a Lechem Mishnah. Lechem Mishnah says that the Rambam very pointedly left it out because he assumes that we don't hold like this teretz. And that's why neither Rava nor Rav Safra were comfortable with this teretz. Rav Safra was only comfortable actually saying outright, no, we didn't come to greet you, but I would have done it anyway, but not relying upon simply the fact that he knew that inside and therefore wouldn't have to say anything. And Rava was only comfortable with the justification of, well, it was an unwarranted assumption. Since it was an unwarranted assumption, I don't have to say anything. However, they did not go along with the possibility. They only went along with the possibility of the first answer, right, that Rabbi Yehuda didn't form Ula, and Rav Safra followed that answer. And Rava said, we don't have to follow that answer in this case because Mazutra made an unwarranted inference based on the circumstances. So he says, we don't hold that way. And the Lev Aryeh of Aaron Levine found that the Lev Aryeh, 19th century authority, gives an explanation for this. The Lev Aryeh gives an explanation. He says that most people are not on the level of Rabbi Yehuda, that they can trust their own subjective self-assessment that they would have done it anyway. Right now, they can say they would have done it anyway because it's something which doesn't cost them anything. If they happen to, meet somebody on the street because they were taking a walk into the other town anyway, so it's no money out of their pocket, they could say, yeah, I would have done it anyway. But if they wouldn't have had a reason to go out and to travel this long distance, and it would have taken time, and it would have taken money, and it would have taken planning and all of those things, so who really can make that type of a hypothetical, theoretical assessment regarding what they would have done if it would have taken time and trouble and money? Not everybody, we assume, is on that madrega, and therefore he says that, that you cannot rely upon that second teretz. So that it would have to be either there was full disclosure by you, or the only reason that you wouldn't have the obligation to give full disclosure is if it would be an unwarranted assumption. However, as I said, Sma, the Aruch HaShulchan seem to assume that you would have the right to rely upon this, but nonetheless, Rav Levine, who certainly is one of the poskim achronim, when it comes to this issue, thinks that that is something that should be taken into account. But he says that, that this plays a role where we see perhaps a contradiction. If you would assume that we would hold this way, then there would be a contradiction. Otherwise, not necessarily a contradiction. It says in the puffery context, because that's also one of the halakas that we have here. In Pakistan, lo adam lo behem lo kelim, gilam tzvah zaken zakan evet haomei limkor kedei shira kibacher. Like, for example, we don't dress up a young Eved to darken his beard or darken his hair if we're not going to cover his hair. There are different girsos, the kind of Eved or Eved Zaken, that in order to make him look like he's a youngster and therefore be able to, you know, sell him for a better price on the market. The same thing with an old, decrepit behemoth. You don't make it look like a really nice young behemoth. And the same thing with Kalim. What? Exactly what we're getting at. Exactly what we're getting at. No. Baruch, you know, Kibanta. So we see that you're not allowed to do all of these things. But Rav Moshe says, if I would have a young worker, he's a young, vibrant, energetic, okay, good worker, he's applying for a job, and he can provide, he's 30 years old, the Ben Shloshim Lekoach, he has like all the energy in the world to be able to make a great impression, but he's prematurely gray. Prematurely gray, have you ever hear such a thing? Person prematurely gray, and he's afraid that that's going to really hurt his job prospects. Is he allowed to dye his hair? So he has a whole discussion about what about Begadisha, he's doing the beautification, he's doing it for job purposes, and it's just one part of his body, Me'acham Ne'atzina, the box says if it's only one thing, then it's not a problem, and he gets out of that. But then he says, what about the issue of Abonah of Eim Pachasin, about the Gnevas Das. What about Gnevas Das, that you're fooling the employer? So Moshe says, no, it's not Gnevas Das. And he quotes also Moshe Mordechai Epson, Moshe Mordechai, and he quotes from Eliezer Meir Prel. They all say that this case is, it's incredible. Everybody all got together to permit this case. I don't know what it is about this particular scenario that, like, you know, you don't see Moshe say, yeah, I got together with this one and with that one, and we all, I don't, all right, anyway. So Moshe said, but anyway, he says that he found that they also, you know, were masking. They all permitted this case of a prematurely gray worker because they said here, and this is very, very important, here what you're doing is not creating a false impression. That was sort of, you know, one of the first things that we mentioned of Gnevas Das. You can't create a false impression. No, they're dispelling a misimpression because they're dispelling a misimpression that all of these employers are going to think that this person is so old and they can't do the job. But really, in reality, they're a young fellow. It's just that they're belied by the color of their hair, which would be fine if they're applying to be a dayan, but not if they're applying for any other position. And therefore, in order to dispel that misimpression, rather than create a false impression, it would be 100% permissible. But why, ask Rabbi Levine, in this case, do we trust the person's own self-assessment? If the delay body says we don't, then maybe we pass him like the Lecha Mishnah, although maybe we don't. But he gives an answer. He says, even if you assume like the Leib Aryeh, there's a distinction between routine circumstances of a person going into a job and doing the job every single day, and you'd be able to check very quickly and see whether they're able to do the job like a young person and not like a young person, and what he refers to as extraordinary hypothetical situations. And extraordinary hypothetical situations would be like, you know, would I really go to the train tracks to meet this person when he came into town, you know, in the train station? I really have no idea if I would have done that under those circumstances. So therefore, we don't rely upon that assessment. And would I have opened the barrel for this person? I can't really say, like Rav Yehuda, necessarily that I would have done that. So that's, you know, one thing that he also throws into the mix is that you have to look in a particular situation. Am I dispelling a misimpression? Or am I creating a false? Am I creating a false impression? And of course, the main case, and this comes up with respect to advertising all the time, that really is discussed, you know, in the Gemara along these lines that I have been waiting for, but I'll bring it into the mix now, is the case of the non-kosher meat. The case of the non-kosher meat. We leave aside, you know, the Gita Nasha case. That's where Rashi makes his favorite, you know, his famous comment about the yisur being machzik tov v'chinam. But the other case that the Gemara talks about is that there happens to be treif meat. There happens to be treif meat. So there's an announcement. This may sometimes make an announcement. Make an announcement in the marketplace that there's treif meat available. What is the nature of the announcement that there's treif meat? So that the non-Jews will know that there's treif meat, that's, and the Jews will know not to buy it necessarily. So it's, they say, Nafo Bisro Livnei Chela. Nafo Bisro Livnei Chela. So the Gemara says, why do you say Nafo Bisro Livnei Chela? That means there's meat available for the soldiers. We're talking about, you know, the non-Jewish soldiers. There's meat available for the soldiers. They were always like quartered in different places and so forth. There's meat available for the non-Jewish soldiers in the neighborhood. So why not say, if you're going to be honest, go all the way. Nuffel trefa. Nuffel trefa. There's treif meat. The answer is, you say nuffel trefa. That doesn't sound so good. Yes, treif, you know, treif. Garbage, you know, absolutely no good, unkosher, non-kosher meat that we really don't want in the worst way, and we're making this available for the non-Jews. So if you're a non-Jew, you're going to want to buy that? You're not going to want to buy that because that sounds like it's defective merchandise. It's not really defective merchandise, just something that we can't eat. It's perfectly fine meat, but if you use a pejorative term like saying treif meat, that's treif, you know, this is for the shkatzim. So you're going to use the terminology along those lines. They're not going to want it. So therefore, you're allowed to use a sort of intermediate language. You can't say this is kosher meat. You can't say it's kosher meat because that would be creating a false impression and engendering undeserved goodwill. But you're allowed to say nafo bisro l'mechelam, and everybody kind of gets it. They all sort of understand that this terminology means that it is not kosher, but at the same time, if you're not disparaging the product, there's no requirement. You're supposed to be brutally honest with respect to all the defects of a particular product, but you're not obligated to unduly disparage a particular product either. So why is it over here that the butchers are relying upon their own self-assessment that the customers in the marketplace are going to understand the meaning of nafo biso, you're being kind of coy. Nafo biso livnei chela. Why do we assume that they'll understand the meaning behind that? Then it means that it's really genuinely kosher. So Rabbi Levin says that over here you have a few things going for you. Number one, you have a small, homogeneous, small geographical market of merchants who have certain expectations and understandings of whatever terminology becomes well known in the marketplace so that it's, things pick up a particular meaning and you're not going to have like somebody from the outside who's not going to understand the true meaning. Number two, the terminology was not created by the merchants, it was created by the Rabbanim. The Rabbanim came up with this. The Rabbanim said in the Gemara that this is a perfectly fine way of describing it, meaning that they made that assessment as opposed to the ones who would be nogim bedavar, the ones who have a self-interest, as opposed to them making that assessment themselves. And he therefore derives from there that similarly, if you're dealing in the marketplace, let's say you don't have the rabbanim available to tell you what terminology to use to sell your products or not, but you should do like pilot testing from third parties, from some sort of a firm that sees how different types of terms are understood by the population. And as long as Ruba de Ruba of the population, we even have a Mina Matzoi, would understand the terminology a particular way. So then he says that you would be allowed to rely upon that. And if you got it wrong, there'll be an uproar in the marketplace because everybody say, hey, we thought that this was kosher meat and turned out to be, you know, treif meat when they find out about it. So therefore you have corrective forces in the marketplace as well. So when you have corrective forces, a small geographical market, and you have the opportunity for sort of an objective assessment rather than those that are being made by those by individuals and merchants who have a self-interest. So then he says that then you can rely upon those conditions together in order to come up with the appropriate terminology. So I would give like the following example. You're a merchant, okay? And you have merchandise that's selling very slowly. It's not bad, defective merchandise, but selling very slowly. People don't seem to be as interested in this, you know, you have Cabbage Patch dolls or something. For whatever reason, people aren't buying it like, you know, they once were, you know, once upon a time. And therefore, you want to get it out It was that you have been trying to sell it for $30. You figure if I price it at $10, maybe people will actually get it. So how do I describe the $10? Do I say it's a bargain price? If I say it's a bargain price, I'm making it seem like $30 is really a reasonable price, and $10 is a big bargain. $10 is not a bargain. It won't sell for $30. It won't sell for $20. I'll be lucky if it sells for $10. A bargain for me. But I can't tell the consumer base out there this is a bargain price. That would be Gnei V'Sda'as. Say it's a bargain price. It's not really worth more than $10, okay? But if I say this is an unwanted merchandise sale, It's true. People don't seem to want this merchandise. But on the other hand, it's a perfectly fine, viable, well-made, well-manufactured merchandise. It's an unwanted merchandise sale. Nobody's got it. It'll be like Nafal Trefa. The Bnei Chayil. We are saying that there's a foul, putrid piece of meat that's available for the Bnei Chayil. The Bnei Chayil are not going to want it under those circumstances. That's what it sounds like. So what should I say? I should say clearance sale. A clearance sale. So then I'm making it clear that I'm not saying it's a bargain price, but saying, I'm having trouble getting rid of it, but I'm not assigning some sort of a pejorative term. So that's like one application that I would say, nowadays. But you have to be, this teaches us the importance of being careful about labeling, there has to be a clear understanding, like you're selling market, you have a kosher supermarket that's under your hashgacha, and there are lots of products that are being sold in that supermarket that only kosher prescribed them because they have kidneys. Sherim, you know, kosher, the ochle kidneys. So if the term kosher, the ochle kidneys is written in teeny tiny, you know, small print that hardly anybody notices when they're frantically doing their pre-Pesach shopping and they live in an Ashkenazic neighborhood, but it wouldn't occur to them that the supermarket, the kosher supermarket in your hashgacha is going to have all of these kidneys products in it. So then that probably would not be sufficient unless you know from your market study and from checking with people that if I have a separate standalone section that says for Sfardim only, Ashkenazim stay away, something like that. You know, that then everyone would know to be careful not to buy that product. Or if the products say, you know, for Oakley Kidney, it's only not only in small print, but that's like what the product is called. The product is called, you know, kosher only for Sfardim. You know, that's what it's called in big, big, big bold letters. So that probably would also work, but you have to make these types of assessments in the markets. This is very halacha l'maisa. It's mamish very, very halacha l'maisa. And it comes up where if you have a significant minority of the population that is going to be deceived and fooled and make mistakes, so then you know you have a real problem on your hands. And if you are the position that you have authority, responsibility, either as the merchant or as the Rav Amachshir, so there you really have to assess these things. You really have to check these things out in order to determine what is appropriate, or even to mislead a consumer into thinking that something requires hashgacha, doesn't require hashgacha. You have water and detergent with kosher symbols on it. Put a CRC on kosher on detergent. So is that considered to be Gnei V'Sda'as? So there's a whole big discussion amongst the poskim about this particular issue. Many came to the determination that it's not really Gnei V'Sda'as per se, because the consumers by and large want it. Consumers by and large that they want certain items, even if they don't need hashgacha, they want their plates to have an OU on it. Why is that? The plate doesn't need an OU because they want that. What do they need a problem? What do I need to be worried about that there was some pig fat that somehow was absorbed into the plate in the manufacturing, and maybe the halacha doesn't require them to be so machmir, but they want to be machmir. They like being super, super, super machmir when it comes to certain things. So, but you have to make those assessments. Yes. I don't think any normal person is. My sense of every normal person when it comes to matters of Mecca Chomemka, what I'm going to sell, is not the standard. The standard is what's the reality? No. What's the reality in the marketplace? What's the reality in the marketplace? What's the reality of how people are going to interpret the signs that I am conveying? No. But if let's say that the store is under, let's say that it's under my hashgacha, that the store is under my hashgacha. This entire store is under the hashgacha, let's say, of the CRC. I have an entire store, Sarah's Tent, whatever it's called in Chicago. So then there's a certain assumption that we check things out for them. It's a different story. So, for example, we have such a store, and vegetables are sold in the store. So if you look in the list of the CRC, it tells you how to check vegetables for bugs, okay? But somebody going to the store, see it's under our shkacha, they might think everything's been checked out already. So we require that there be a big sign where the vegetables are all being sold, saying these vegetables have not yet been checked, okay? And in order to know how to check each individual vegetable for bugs, please see our website, you know, the following link, and this will tell you what to do. So this is an obligation that you have. You're right. If it was not set up in such a way where a person would have a reasonable basis for their assumption that everything is kosher, you don't need to dispel. But otherwise, then you could say, you are too loud enough shayo. Then you can say, you don't have to have 100%. But otherwise, sometimes you are creating this impression, just like when you have the kosher merchants in the marketplace, where the assumption is that the food is, that the meat that they're slaughtering is kosher unless they say otherwise. Yeah.
Any responsibility at all to the informed consumer. You didn't use those words. I'm exactly.
So you're not relieving them of any responsibility to the degree in which it's reasonable for them to understand that they have responsibilities, and then they still have responsibility. But sometimes if you're presenting a particular store as kosher under your supervision, so then you are, you know, creating certain assumptions that are not unwarranted assumptions. So the Nivsa Sayim and Ratzvi Spitz, so author of the Minchas Tzvi, so they both give another example where basically you're doing something which is a duplicitous practice. What would that be? That would be, so I mentioned this calling something a bargain price. It's not really a bargain price. So let's say I once visited when I was working as a lawyer, so I had to do due diligence once with respect to a customized jewelry company that I think one of our clients was buying, and something I had to check out the company. So I had to go. They actually sent me to this jewelry company, okay, where they had all kinds of different cosmetics and jewelries and pearls and diamonds and necklaces and earrings and bracelets and whatever. Okay, so I'm going and I'm checking everything out in this particular place. Nobody, no customers at the time. Just, you know, they have a few people who are working there and they're showing me around. And they have the woman who's like, you know, the executive, you know, president, whatever, the executive, the CEO of the company. And she's showing me, you know, how everything works. And I was astounded because every single, it was like customized, very fine, very expensive jewelry. Everything was marked down. 50%, 60%, you know, it's just like, everything is like an unbelievable bargain, but like it's $3,000, $5,000, but really it should be $10,000. Really it should be $12,000, whatever. It's just like everything is 60%. So I said, it's amazing. Everything is all like, do you ever sell these items at their actual price? Because everything seems to be marked down as like a special type of year or whatever. You said, no. This is how the industry works. The way the industry works is, people want to feel like they're getting a good deal. So, of course, this is what, you know, it goes for. It goes for, you know, the $3,000 for that. But you always say it's a 60% sale, a 75% sale. Then people feel good about it. It's like, wow, I'm getting such a great deal. So that's how people buy jewelry. That's what she explained that to me. So I think from, yeah? This is before. This is going back. I'm talking 1992. Okay, there was no internet. No, this is... I'm talking about the ancient times, okay? This is right. You're right. Right. Uh-huh. Yeah. She's saying this. Okay. So I would suggest that this type of a kind of, you know, outright lying, like it's one thing when everybody knows that the wine is mixed a little bit with water and so forth, like the Shulchan Aruch talks about later on. But it's outright lying to say that something is, you know, an actual price when it's just really, it doesn't exist. It's not the real price ever. So that probably be negin halacha. So that's what Rav Spitz says. That's what the Nivs HaSayim says as well. It seems very questionable whether halacha would permit something of that sort. Now, let's say you have the unwelcome guest, or not unwelcome, uninvited guest. Somebody walks in, somebody thinks that you invited them. They think you invited them to the wedding. Really, you only invited them to the chuppah. And they show up, you know, they think that they're, you know, invited to the entire suda. I mean, who cares at that point? I would go, whatever. But, or somebody shows up to your house and they think that you invited them and you didn't really invite them and so forth. So, do you have an obligation to correct that misperception? So, again, here as well, if you didn't do anything to create that misperception, so then I would say probably based on the sugya of Mar Ukva and Rosafa and Rava, you don't necessarily have to correct their misconception. So that becomes a little bit uncomfortable, because even if you're not obligated to correct their misconception, you're also not allowed to deliberately mislead somebody. How can you say, "Oh, I'm so happy that you came," if you're not really so happy that they came? That's, you know, like one thing about the halacha of al yasahei v'adam, that you're not supposed to, like, you know, overly plead with somebody to come. I think that it's that lo yisar shiso shisarimo v'yodei she'eno soed. One thing that I think is very, very clear, and you can disagree with me, because I don't think it's so explicit, but I think that it's very, very clear, is that you're certainly not allowed to lie. So you're not allowed to invite someone. Like, you're allowed to invite somebody out of kavod once or twice if you know that they're not going to come, right? You know, you just shouldn't overdo it. But let's say that you're inviting them once or twice, you know they're not going to come. You don't really want them to come. You don't really want them to come. In the event that they would say, "Oh, yeah, sure, I'll come." You go, "Whoa. What? They weren't supposed to say that. Didn't they get the script? They weren't supposed to say, you know." So then I think that already becomes, so that I think is the sugi of Abba Chilkiah. You look at the case of Abba Chilkiah, the Gemara in Tainus of Gimel Amid Beis. So the Rabbanim, you know, came, they're visiting him and so forth, they're checking how he does things, and he does a lot of strange things. And they ask afterwards, "Okay, but why do you do this? Why do you do that? Why do you do that?" They said, "How come you didn't eat when you went there to eat? How come you didn't offer us some bread? How come he didn't offer us anything?" So he says, "Because Mishin Vol Nefisha Rifta, I didn't have enough. Vamina Loachaski Rabbanan." Hold on, I wrote this down over here. Tibusa Bechinam, that the Chachamim shouldn't give me goodwill for no deserved reason. I have no right to say, "Oh, come and eat," even if I know. In that case, they probably would have said, "Oh, no, it's okay. We don't want any bread." But he knew he didn't have enough. He really didn't want the answer to be yes under those circumstances. So that becomes much more difficult. If you remember, in the case of Marzutra and together with Rav and Rav Safa, the end of the day, they really did want to honor him, and they even accompanied him. But let's say you really don't want the guest. So you are not obligated to say, "Oh, we didn't really invite you." You're not really obligated to say, "I didn't really invite you," if the whole thing was not a mistake that was part of, you know, your causing. But to say, "Oh, we're so happy to have you," so that could be a real problem. So I saw Rav Eliezer Melamed has a piece on this, and he says, you know what your obligation is? I like this very much. He says, your obligation is to overcome your yetzer and to work really hard at getting to the point where you really do want them. It'll be an honest statement. You're just like, you know, work on yourself right then and there, work on your midos, you know, and you say, "Oh, yeah, I know you're, you know, you're listed, you know, child, you know, offender, whatever. But nonetheless, you know, you came up and you showed. We're so happy to have you. And it could be that this was the major shortcoming of the whole story of Kamsu Ban Kamsu. That's what should have happened at that point in time. The wrong person showed up, but the host should have said, "It's okay. I really wanted Kamsa, I didn't want Bar Kamsa, but nonetheless, you know, I'm going to overcome my feelings, you know." And it was an unwarranted, you know, assumption on their part. I didn't really invite this person. They didn't have a basis to assume this, whatever, but I'm going to say I want the person anyway. I want you anyway. That's okay. Possibility. There may also, if there were a lot of people present, so there are other Kavod and Chavit Yir, you know, suggestions, considerations as well. And Rav Asher Weiss would just say that, you know, you have to boil down, it boils down to, are you giving yourself kavod? Are you giving the other person kavod? You're giving the other person kavod. So then, and it's not for the purpose of giving yourself kavod to say, "Oh, yeah, yeah, we're so great that we invited you." But you just want the other person to feel good. So it has to be some sort of combination of those circumstances. So that really genuinely does come up from time to time. Okay. Now, next thing that I wanted to talk about is, what if the, you have an actual monetary transaction and you do make a lie about the price, and you say to the individual, and this would really be a violation, like we mentioned, of Ganeva's Das, you say to the individual in question that everybody has offered me $100 for this product. And the person says, "Oh, okay, you know, you have 10 people who offer you $100 for this product. They only wanted to pay you $80, but you say, but they say, okay, I'll give you $100. And let's assume I don't have an owner concern. Like, there's a range. The product could be anywhere from $60 to $120, you know, depending on the people's, you know, likes and affinities and so forth. That's a separate shiur. What's the range of owner? But let's say it's not going to be a problem of owner per se. But the person gave you the money because you made this misrepresentation to them. So does that become a bitul mekach? Does that become a bitul mekach? So we don't really find in Geneva's Das territory that it creates a bitul mekach. The Taz, in Kosh Mishpat, Simen Shin Lamed Beis of all places, says, Umaisim b'chol yom. This is scary. It says, Umaisim b'chol yom, she'odem mochdeh mochdeh l'chaveh l'chepetz, that a person will sell an item to somebody, and he'll get a certain price by saying, all these other people were willing to pay me the high price, and I didn't want to sell to them. So you should consider yourself lucky that I'm willing to sell to you at this price, but I certainly can't sell for lower than that. And the person says, well, okay. It turns out the whole thing was just smoke and mirrors, was all completely made up and fabricated. We're not going to be mevatel the mekach. Only if the purchaser says to me, I'm going to pay you this price, but I'm only paying you this price on the basis that what you said better be true, that there were these other people that offered you this price. And if it turns out not to be true, so then I want my money back. So only if the person actually makes that stipulation. But otherwise, we assume that the merchants are sometimes these sleazy, conniving, dishonest people. And unless you make your acquisition dependent upon them really telling you the truth, so he says, yes, there's Gnevis Das, but it is not Mebatel Mekach. So that's another Nafkamina. We're talking about the Nafkaminas between, you know, what are the standard cases that we spoke about in the previous sim and we learned about in the previous sim and Bitul Mekach, and what are some of the differences with respect to Gnevis Das? That's a very, very important difference. Yes?
My wife, when she realized that she was just the opposite. She was a piano involved. Set up several friends to go to the press and disparage the that's a ridiculous price. So after being barraged by the people, the original owner said, well, maybe I got it wrong. Maybe I was asking too much. And the person came back bought the price they really intended.
So that's Gnevis Das in the opposite direction. That's a very good, good illustration. Gnevis Das in the opposite direction. Okay, right. Would the Taz say that that transaction would also stand up, or would that somehow be worse? Because we expect better from the purchasers than we do of the sellers. I don't know. It's a very interesting question. Very interesting question. So how do we reconcile this idea of unwarranted assumptions with the Yerushalmi Makos that says that a Talmid Chacham has to disclose it to a community that it gets based on Mishnah and Shulos, v'zed dvar ha-rotzeach, that a Talmid Chacham has to dispel any notion that the people in his community, he knows one mesechta. He knows one, that's pretty good. He knows one mesechta. And now, somehow, in his community, they think that he knows two mesechta. I don't know any rub where this happened to. Our rub, he knows two mesechta. I don't think it really happened. But whatever, you can figure, you know, some equivalent examples. So does he have to disclose that he only knows one mesechta? So Yerushalmi says yes. So why is that? Just because he quoted something from the second mesechta, or he didn't say they knew a second mesechta? Isn't that an unwarranted assumption? So the Maharit says, yeah, it's a really good question. Why should that be true according to Yerushalmi? Maybe it's not the halacha, but he says maybe, you know, he's being honored especially for it. Rav Spitz says maybe the case is they're like giving him like an extra, he's getting like an extra parking space. Like if you know one mesechta, you don't get a parking spot. But if you know two mesechta, so then the show gives you a parking space. You know, I remember like when I came to the CRC, it was some discussion. Should I give me a parking space? Yeah, that's okay. I don't need a parking space. But, you know, now we regret it. I don't need a parking space. But I come nice and early to work. Usually I get a parking space. It's okay. So maybe if you know two mesechtos, so then maybe you're getting like some sort of a special honor from it. So, but otherwise, very difficult. So Rabbi Levine gives the following explanation. It's, no, it's not unwarranted assumption. Because the Balabatim are just Balabatim. They don't really know anything. The person gives a shiur on one mesechta, and he happens to bring in a gemara in the second mesechta. Since it's all interconnected, so it's a legitimate assumption that they have to assume that since he brought in a sugya from a second mesechta, maybe he really knows that mesechta. But he doesn't really know that mesechta. He's just quoting, you know, one sugya, one reference from that mesechta. So therefore, it is a warranted assumption. That's why he has to dispel it. An incredible thing. The Pesachei Choshen says, a boy says, I'll tell you something. Maybe, according to the Din Yerushalmi, we're talking about a perfect world. The perfect world, so fine, so you correct, you show what a tzaddik you are. No, I really don't know one mesechta, I don't know the second mesechta. He says, if that's going to cause them to give you a demotion, they're going to be mevazing you. You don't know a second mesechta. This guy is thinking, we're cutting his salary in half. You know, we're going to step all over him. We're no longer listening to your psakim. We're going to paskin for ourselves. We're going to bring in a Maharaj tonight. Forget it, you know. So if that's going to be the result, so then you do not have an obligation to say anything because you're not obligated to be mevazit yourself in the process of disclosure. So interesting question nowadays. You become a new rabbi of the community and you haven't yet gotten your smicha, okay? This has been known to happen in one or two cases. You know, a person becomes a rabbi of the community, everybody's calling him a rabbi. Does he have to disclose that he doesn't have a smicha yet? So here I think it relates to sort of the continuation of Siman Reish Chof Ches, which is Malkum Shenogu. Everybody knows, I think by now, it's become commonplace, especially with young rabbanim. Maybe it's not true for 65-year-old rabbi. But with young rabbanim, I think that it's become commonplace. The shuls know that it's just out of a kavod. Even a rabbinical student, you start calling him rabbi once he starts functioning as a rabbi, even if he doesn't quite have a smicha yet. I don't think that it becomes a disclosure issue because I think it's already become a malkum shenogu. I know that for lawyers, if they call you Esquire before you actually Esquire, you can get into a lot of trouble. You get in a lot of trouble for that. You're supposed to, you know, correct it. You're supposed to sign your documents in particular. I remember my first year as an associate, I wasn't allowed to use the Esquire until, you know, I got my bar, you know, exam, you know, results back and got sworn in. It was like a few months or so. But I think for Rabbi, we probably have the Malkum Shenogu. Rabbi Levine. Arvid, like Reb. Right. That's why when I write to anybody, right. When I write to anybody, everybody is R apostrophe. Everybody is R apostrophe. You know what I'm saying? Right. Yeah. Depends where. Depends on what context. Yeah. That's very interesting. Okay, so. Somebody said the bracha for a chef there, and he said, "Amen, can you hear us out?"
Can
you hear us out?
I never said the bracha three times before that, but you never heard it.
Okay, so a couple more examples. So when I was once davening in a particular shul, regularly from Mincha Maariv, a particular shul when I was living in the city, and there was somebody who would say these beautiful divrei Torah between Mincha Maariv every single day. And he would always have like two or three very short, sweet divrei Torah. And I thought, this is really fantastic. And so then I started listening, like when I was communing, I started listening to the tapes, the divrei Torah, Parshas of Shavua tapes of Rabbi Fran. And I was listening to the tapes of Rabbi Fran, and the divrei Torah sounded very familiar. Parshas Vayetze, there'd be three divrei Torah in a row, and they were the three divrei Torah that the guy said for Parshas Vayetze. But Yishlak would be three divrei Torah, the three divrei Torah, Parshas Vayetze. Quoting exactly the same authority, same question, same answer, same everything. It was all straight from Rabbi Fran's tapes. It was a beautiful divrei Torah. But the fellow didn't say, oh, I heard from Rabbi Fran the following three divrei Torah. He said, oh, the Beis Av says this, and the Meshiv Nefesh says that, and the, whatever the Sfarim was. Okay, it was just a one after the and whoa, this Yosef says this. And I walked over to the fellow and I said, you know, I've been listening to your divrei Torah and I realized that they're all straight from Rabbi Fran. Don't you think it might be like a nice thing to give attribution? And he said to me, why? There's a perfectly fine divrei Torah, like who cares, like where they came from? And that was his response. So I think that is going to have a stop. That's Kleina Vistas. Rabbi Levine writes about this specific. He writes, somebody gives a shir, and they use a whole bunch of sources, and they're all secondary sources, because he's using one sefer that presents all the sources one after the other. He doesn't mention that he got it from that sefer. So he says, if you have at least a mina matzoi of people who are there who think that the rabbi looked up all these sources himself, so then he says that it's mamish Kleina Vistas. That, I mean, besides the fact that you're not giving, you know, proper attribution, maybe Gula Olam, by giving, you know, the original source, but nonetheless, that would also be an example of Gnei Vistas, that you really should give the source. If you look up, you look at in a divrei Torah book, Yituri Torah, or, you know, whatever, Likute Basa Likute, or whatever it happens to be, and you see like a nice board, from the Ksav Sofer, from the Ksav Sofer, from anybody else, and the Beis HaLevi, and then you open up your Ksav Sofer, you open up your Beis HaLevi, and you look it up yourself. So then 100% you've taken ownership of it. You looked it up yourself. Maybe you'll even say it over a little bit differently based on a nuance that you detect. But if you're relying primarily solely on this source, so then you really should quote it. You really should quote it. I've gotten up and said, oh, I saw a great Torah from Rabbi Finn. Nobody's like pelting me with stones and said, oh, he's an illegitimate rabbi or anything. Like, what's wrong with that? Oh, it's unbelievable. I did it like every day.
Exactly.
Did it every day.
I saw it brought in the name of Samsov.
That much, it's not going to be done. I saw it brought in the name of Samsov. I think it's perfectly fine. But to say that Samsov is dead, but that's how I saw it brought in the name of Samsov.
I've had experience with the secondary sources, either oversimplified the story or not. On the original sources, I thought it was being differently. So the person always himself looked it up, and not just rely on
as much as we can. You know, I tell my Tavini right here in this room, when A quotes B, right there this morning, never, never rely on A quotes B. We had it today.
Oh yeah.
Right.
Oh yeah. They lie all the time. They lie all the time. I use lie in a cute fashion.
Right.
Whatever. I don't lie. You know, directly. Right. Yeah. But right. Okay. So, yeah. Yes. And he has said, and Rabbi Raggi, he wrote that in his Chubos. He said, Opello, that this person quoted like these three lines from my Chubos without giving me attribution. I've seen Rabbi Raggi actually write that in his Chubos. He actually wrote that in his Chubos. And I've seen articles, when I've researched a particular halakhic topic, I have sometimes seen articles that quote verbatim from another article that I looked at, of a three paragraphs completely copied and pasted without any attribution whatsoever. I've seen that. I've mamish seen it. It's an unbelievable scene. What? Yeah. I find it absolutely shocking. But that's already getting into the realm of plagiarism. Already getting into the realm of plagiarism.
So recently, when someone wrote an article, that he quotes that somebody lifted from this guy without attribution.
The commentator on February 18, 1987. Published an issue which was that particular year was the year that the commentator got the award as like the most productive or most virtuous religious club on campus. Okay, because that year the commentator was run by B'nai Torah. It was run by B'nai Torah and had articles on Torah topics. I was zocheh to serve as the feature editor that particular year, and there was an article in that particular issue about cheating on exams and why it is halakhically problematic. It was written by Rabbi Aaron Cohn, a Shlita, who is now a rabbi in Passaic, New Jersey. Thou shalt not... Oh, wow. How did that happen? Yeah, you did that one? Thou shalt not cheat. A halakhic perspective. Not Freddie Schwartz. This is an article by Rabbi... I mean, he's a very fine person too, but this is an article by Rabbi Aaron Cohn, quoting from many of the sources that talk about just the actual Isurim that relate to cheating on exams. It's an incredible thing that Rav Moshe had to write a tshuva, but be'isra genevas tshuvas l'shelos mifchanei asim she'osa medina, stealing regions. Is it permissible to steal regions? This doesn't really require any, you know, rigorous analysis. It's so obviously usher. And yet, the reason there was this article is because I don't know if it's still a problem now. I hope it's not. But back in 1987, it was a problem that you had students in a Torah institution like Yeshiva University who actually cheated on exams. It's the most incredible thing. It's a terrible, terrible thing. Right. And I don't understand when we talk about just the pernicious nature of Geneva's Das, which is an Isser Sheker Geneva, it's an Isser, you know, mitos on the soul, like the Rambam talks about even one word of pitoy geneva's das is considered to be a terrible stain on the soul. So Rav Moshe, you can see, like, barely was able to complain himself, and apparently this was, you know, something that was going on. He said, not only is the problem of Dina de Malchus Adina, it's a problem of Din Torah. It's not only Geneva's Das, where Shmuel says you can't steal, you can't do Geneva's Das with respect to an Akum, but it's Geneva Mamish. It's Geneva Mamish, because the people are going to get jobs they don't deserve. They're going to have a job and something's going to go wrong, and the employer is going to assume, oh, this very fine Ben Torah who got really good grades can't be the one responsible. It must be somebody else who is responsible, and that person is going to get into trouble. Also, in Isser, you know, Sheker, Bishra Sheker, Tirkok, or Sashakri, you're not allowed to lie with respect to anything. And you'll say, oh, well, the people really wouldn't be Makri. He says, of course they'll be Makri. They want people who got really good grades to get the jobs. So it's a Geneva's Das that ends up being Mamish, a Geneva's Moment, where you're really stealing money from people altogether. And then he says what undoubtedly Rav Moshe meant is a little bit of Musar, although I'm sure there was sincerity to it as well. It says, Aval Barah She'etzim Adova She'shama Malas Kevodo, that which you heard that they're thinking, a yeshiva is thinking about stealing regions, who sheker, misonia yeshivos. Obviously, that's like a blood libel, because how could such a thing? They're considered, they're the best students when it comes to everything. It's absolutely impossible that they would be guilty of such a thing. And he writes similarly with respect to the previous tshuva, in terms of a Mossad Torah receiving for its yeshiva more money by pretending that it has like more students than it really has. So he says that there as well, besides it being an Isser Sheker, it's a Chilul Hashem, it's a Bizayon HaTorah, it's a, you're being Rodev Gedolei HaTorah Tamidayim. And he says, why in the world do you have a yeshiva altogether? It's in order to instill proper Torah values to the students. Who can neged kol taklis yesodi yeshiva so alimut sham, la'tamidim liros yirei Hashem be'emes lizar b'sui mamon b'yoyser. So how can you possibly have this as a foundation of what is going on within your yeshiva? It makes absolutely no sense whatsoever.
But it was.
What?
But it was.
But it happened.
In my class, they distracted the dean and I called the state during final exam.
Really?
So that's the way it was told to me. I mean, I
wow. Wow.
1989.
Okay.
I graduated from the
89 New York Post published the entry.
That's true. The New York Post posted. I know that's absolutely true. They posted it.
Right, right. But okay, at least they posted it so that people wouldn't take advantage of it, so that they would put an end to. But my point is that we should really be at the forefront of those who demonstrate how we are Anshei Emes in everything that we do. That's what we pray for, right? We want, you know, a banu b'nei banim tamnei chachamim, you know, Anshei Emes yirei Elokim. It's just something that I think is a very, you know, sobering reminder. That Tzitz Eliezer has his tshuva about the person who was asking whether he could fabricate, you know, medical papers and medical data in order to make his papers, you know, more publishable, so he'll get his promotions because nobody ever reads the medical papers anyway. And and he says, you know, similarly that basically that's why I mean it's a fascinating thing. But he also quotes from the pasuk in Yirmiyahu. That you can't have bichu, even if it would have no ramifications, which of course it does, there's a concept of limud l'shanam dabi ha-sheker, the pasuk in Yirmiyahu, that it's considered to be a terrible thing to habituate yourself to sheker. That's why Rav told his son Rechia, don't, you know, change what your mother says or, you know, what you tell your mother in terms of, you know, whether I want beans or lentils, so she'll do the opposite, because even though I'll get what I want, but nonetheless, you're going to habituate yourself when it comes to sheker. He does a whole essay about not, you know, about driving up prices in appeals when the person who's, you know, bidding really just wants to get the other people to bid more money, and then if he ends up holding the bag, they'll cut the amount that he has to pay in half, obviously as many, many Yisurim. There are many tshuvos that really talk about this notion of how careful you have to be people libo shoven, that you're not, you know, taking advantage of gullibility, particularly when it's going to cause harm to others, and not creating a false impression and disabusing anybody from assigning to you false or, you know, goodwill, undeserved goodwill. I think we have to really take all of these things to heart. I'll just, you know, finish by one other comment in the siman that the Aruch HaShulchan says that, you know, promotional practices are okay if they're legitimate, meaning that you are making, you know, a good item look better, or, you know, good item look particularly good. You have an excellent car and you make it shiny, so that's considered to be okay. But similarly, you have the right to go into the marketplace and to make your product like a better product than everybody else's product and to have a better price than everybody else's price, as long as the Ochel Shulchan says, as long as it's not a predatory pricing, that you can't engage, like, you know, if you're some big mega store, you know, operation, and you can put like millions of dollars into driving out the other businesses by having ridiculously low prices that the market can't really bear, but you have the ability to just, you know, lose like a lot of money at the beginning in order to make a lot of money afterwards, but it's not really market price. So that type of predatory pricing, it's really a Hasagas Gvul issue a little bit in terms of what types of practices are allowed, but it does appear in the Siman, so it's worth mentioning the issue that we have in Halacha with respect to predatory pricing. If you are going to price something low, it has to be because you're particularly efficient using market forces for a reasonable market price, but not to drive out competitors. Yes? What year was that Tzitzeliezer published? I don't know. It's in Chelek Tesov Simen Yud Beis, and you'll take a look as to what the year was if it was published. I don't have that in front of me. Yeah.
Tried, convicted, removed stripper's license, the whole false connection of autism and measles vaccination was fabricated by a gastroenterologist who had some vendetta on what happened to vaccination. He was tried, convicted, incarcerated, stripper's license, and people still swear by him. There are firm communities where he invited him as a guest speaker and still swear by it, even though holding the fabrication of
his incarceration is over.
Look, I mean, people talk about don't take advantage of money back offers that you're only supposed to take advantage of if you're not satisfied with the product, when you know they're buying the product in order to return it altogether. Ben Ishkai talks about not tasting, you know, Arab yogurt that I guess was kosher at the time when you don't have the intention to buy it and you're only supposed to sample in order to return it. Lots and lots of actual practical halachamaisa examples, both in the marketplace with respect to rabbanim, with respect to hashkachos, and with respect to our private, you know, day-to-day interactions. So I just wanted to raise some of those scenarios to see how the halacha would play out. Some of the answers are clear. Some of the answers are more, you know, vague, but just to give all the different considerations that have to come into play whenever we have to make these types of assessments.
Okay.
Okay. Yes, okay.